Good morning. Beautiful Lord's Day. Colossians chapter 4, verse 6. We're going to get it done. Colossians chapter 4, verse 6. Right here in the last few stages of Paul's letter to this young church, he's been talking about some general instructions that would benefit every Christian. As you recall, there in chapter 3 into chapter, first part of chapter 4, there were some specific instructions for certain groups and relationships. But here, really in verse 2 is where it started. Let me start reading in Colossians 4, verse 2, and we'll work our way to verse 6. Paul says, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving, praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open to us a door for the word, so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I have also been imprisoned, that I may make it clear in the way I ought to speak. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. He's talking with Ray before class this morning, and that verse came up. I knew it was Colossians, but I didn't realize it was just the last verse we studied last week. This idea of making the most of the opportunity we were discussing. Seems like the older I get in life, and maybe you've experienced as well, time goes by quicker. I don't know how that works. There's probably a scientific explanation for it. I know an hour still is as long as it is at age 60, whatever it is now, and what it was at 24, but
well, there you go.
That makes some sense. So I just attribute it to there's, you know, just kind of like an old hard drive. You get so much in the brain that sometimes you got to hit Control Alt Delete and start over. But anyway, making the most of the opportunity, you know, that would really be probably a good mantra for the Christian life, right? Whatever area of our life, we only have a certain amount of opportunities, so I guess we need to make the most of them. All right, verse 6. Paul says, let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you ought, or should, rather, respond to each person. Really, I think verse 5 that we just mentioned a little bit ago, is in the context of Paul talking about how, would you please pray for me, Paul says, so that I can speak in a way that the gospel would be clear. And then this idea about conducting ourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, I think that thought stream is still there. You know, as non-apostles, we interact with the world around us, and most often probably we do it with words, and maybe that's why Paul brings it up here. In verse 6, words are a way that we often, and maybe most often, interact with outsiders. So Paul here offers counsel on how we should speak to others. And he highlights three examples of godly speech, and I've just characterized them this way. First of all, graceful words, then seasoned words, and then carefully chosen words. Seems like Paul, in some place in all of his letters, gets around to talking about our speech. And perhaps that's just the same idea that, you know, James has a lot to say about it as well. The idea that that might be the one part of the body we have as much trouble corralling as any other part of the body. I don't know. But let's talk first about this graceful speech. Let your speech always be with grace. Speak gracefully is to speak what is spiritual, wholesome, fitting, kind, sensitive, purposeful, complimentary, gentle, truthful, loving, thoughtful. That was one study Bible note that I referenced there. But maybe just at the I'll ask you first. What would it mean to you to speak gracefully to someone? Okay. All right. That's a struggle, isn't it? Okay. It's the thought that counts, though, right? And I know you think gracefully. Okay? Yeah, when I thought about it a bit, go ahead. And that's the power of words, isn't it? Yeah, I was thinking from the vantage point of, you know, most of us have an idea what grace is, right? So if we speak in ways that extend grace to others, that may mean biting our tongue when we want to say something that we shouldn't. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking I was thinking, as some of you were sharing there, you know, sometimes we take pride in being the person, well, I just tell it like it is. Well, maybe speaking gracefully would change that to where I'm speaking, I tell it like it ought to be, or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, go ahead. I was thinking as you were talking that all of us probably can think of somebody in our mind that we would define as this type of person. And Jim hinted at it, that person that can kind of defuse the situation. There's more of us that get in, especially when we're spoken harshly too. We want to throw gas on that fire, and that's so easy to do, but it takes more courage to be that, speak a word, a graceful word into that situation. It may not work, but we're still called to try to do it the graceful way. So, let's talk a bit about the next one here, seasoned words. Let your speech also be with grace, as though seasoned with salt. Here's a way a couple others tried to describe this. Our words should impact our conversations for the better as we bring flavor to our interactions, build others up, and share as well as defend the gospel. The content and tone of our words should impact those around us for the better, especially unbelievers. Sharing the gospel includes knowing it, sharing it accurately, and doing so with a humble and gracious attitude. And that, by the way, is probably the hardest thing, that sometimes we think that, you know, since we're doing God's work and sharing His message, we can do it in a harmful or hurtful way. And, you know, we're called to speak the truth in love. But anyway, yes, we should always be ready to answer others' questions about our faith, but our words should also reflect Christ, bringing a different flavor to what otherwise might be an unsavory conversation. Maybe that's what's going on here. I don't know. Maybe you have a take on that, but as though seasoned with salt, Jesus, of course, talked about His followers being the salt of the earth, Matthew chapter 5, 13. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It's good for nothing except to be thrown out and be trampled underfoot by men. So maybe being the salt of the earth ought to make its way to our mouth so we speak as though, you know, we're not talking about salty words here in the way that's normally taken, okay? Yes, salty words in a godly way. Thoughts on that? Seasoned with salt. Makes them and I meant to say a while ago. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, the tone plays into it, right? The tone of our words. We had Wayne, then we'll come back up here. Justifiably so, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking somehow, I think it's part of the curse of the internet age has affected this part of it because, you know, public dialogue has really, you know, fallen into hard times, and I think it's because, you know, we can hide behind our keyboards. And yeah. There's I can't remember where the verse is. I don't think I've got it here in my notes, but biblically speaking, there was salt was part of how they made covenants, and I don't remember how all that plays in, but so maybe that has a factor as well. So we've got graceful words, according to Paul. We've got seasoned words. The third one there in verse 6 says how that you will know, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. I've just referred to that as carefully chosen words. You see, different situations often require different words, right? And it takes some wisdom to know Here's a good example. Wayne mentioned Solomon. In Proverbs 26, verses 4 and 5, notice what happens in these two verses. Verse 4 says, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will also be like him." Then verse 5 says, "Answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he may not be wise in his own eyes." And, you know, depending how that's translated in some versions, you know, those unbelievers will grab that and say, "Well, look, the Bible contradicts itself in two verses right next to one another." No. What Solomon is saying is, you deal with a fool depending on the situation, right? You don't want to talk to a fool like he talks to you, or you'll be like him. Answer a fool as his folly deserves. That's choosing your words for that situation. A couple others from Proverbs. I meant to work these in earlier in this discussion. Psalm 37:30 says, "The mouth of the righteous utters wisdom, but and his tongue speaks justice." Proverbs 15:4, "A soothing tongue is a tree of life, but perversion in it crushes the spirit." So there's that. You know, tongue can be used both ways. Proverbs 15:7, "The lips of the wise spread knowledge, but the hearts of fools are not so." And here's the one probably most people remember from Proverbs with regard to words. Proverbs 25:11 says, "Like apples of gold and settings of silver is a word spoken in right circumstances." Maybe it's the King James says, "fitly spoken," something like that. I think that fits pretty well here with knowing how to respond to each person. Choose your words carefully according to the need of the moment. Right? And again, all of this is under the umbrella of speaking the truth in love. So you can even say some difficult things in a careful way without being ugly about it. Yeah, words have this way. Like I say, it can be gasoline on a fire, or it can be a fire extinguisher and still make a point. The illustration comes to my mind is, I've been around church work a long time, even before I've been around the church since I've been a baby, but I've attended a lot of business meetings over the years, and I've got a whole repository of words used in the wrong way in a lot of those meetings. I mean, to our detriment. I see some smiles. I probably use some of those words. So that's just one illustration, though. And if Paul here again maybe is thinking about the Colossians' influence on outsiders, that's a powerful. We ought to practice these things among each other first and foremost. But again, how we speak affects our witness in the world around us. Whole lot of stuff here in one verse, right? Amazing what the Spirit can work in there. Anything else on the speech thing? Yeah, again, the word atmosphere has become pretty coarse in our world. That's the culture we live in. And maybe the more it declines, then the right kind of speech will stand out even more. He was describing that there. I've had that happen a lot in the years I've been a preacher, that I can remember, and I don't know that I've always answered the right way, but that happened to me. I'd go out and help somebody on the farm and be working with these guys because that's what I was raised to know. But they'd all of a sudden learn what I did for a living. And, they'd been talking like a sailor, as Jim talks about, talking like a farmer. And once they learned what I did, it was, I'm sorry, I shouldn't. Yeah, yeah, that's right. And I remember responding a couple of times with this. I said, "Well, I'm not the guy you need to worry about." I don't know whether that's the right response there, but yeah, I was a younger man then. But so anyway, all right. Peter's going. He wants to say something. He knows better. All right. We got a little bit. I guess about 10 minutes. Let's move into the latter section of the Colossian letter, and here, this again is similar to most of Paul's writings. He gets to a point right near the end where It's just kind of some general housekeeping things, and it's real easy to read through them pretty quickly because there's not necessarily a whole lot of doctrine being taught there or Christian instruction. He just mentioned some names, but I do think it's important to just not skip over these things because, you know, it just shows, if you will, the importance of relationships to the apostle in these churches. Verse 7 and 8, he says, "As to all my affairs, Tychicus," I'm not sure if that's exactly how you say it, but some people say Tychicus, but "Tychicus, our beloved brother and faithful servant and fellow bondservant in the Lord, will bring you information, for I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that you may know about our circumstances and that he may encourage your hearts." So this particular name means fortuitous or fortunate. Tychicus was one of the Gentile converts Paul took to Jerusalem as a representative of the Gentile churches in Acts chapter 20 and verse 4. We're right in the middle of this part of Acts on Wednesday nights in our Bible study here. And so this is fresh in our minds. But yeah, as Paul on that third missionary journey, as Paul's making his way back for that final time to Jerusalem, is going to get in a heap of trouble. Didn't take Paul long to get in trouble most anywhere he went. But Paul took along some representatives of from the Gentile churches. The main purpose kind of seems, as Luke describes it, they took up this collection. The saints in Judea were having a rough time due to a famine, so Paul encouraged the Gentile churches to help with some funds, and he's taking them back with him, and he takes some of the representatives from those various churches with him just to kind of keep things above board. Well, this Tychicus was one of those. He and Tychicus were with Paul. Let's see. Oh, no, I'm jumping ahead here. I'm sorry. There we go. Get back in the right place in the notes. He was a reliable companion of Paul, apparently, and a capable leader, since he was considered as a replacement for Timothy and Titus on separate occasions. You can read about that in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12, and Titus chapter 3, verse 12. So some of these names we're going to run across right here at the end are only mentioned this one time. Tychicus comes up several times. Tychicus had the responsibility to deliver Paul's letters to the Colossians, the Ephesians, read about that in Ephesians 6:21, and to Philemon here in this very text. We're going to, the next couple of verses, we'll read about him as well. So apparently Tychicus was the one that Paul entrusted with this very letter. Paul wrote it or dictated it to someone, and he's carrying it back. That was the mail system in those days. All right, you've got right there in verse 8, "I've sent him to you for this purpose, that you may know about our circumstances and that he may encourage your heart." You may remember early on, it seems likely from the way Paul writes here, that Paul had never met these people in this church in person. We're going to be introduced to Epaphroditus again before here in just a little bit. Probably won't get to it today, but he was the one, apparently, that kind of took the gospel back to Colossae, and Paul likely taught Epaphroditus. So anyway, he's writing to people he don't know very well, and Tychicus is kind of the go-between. He's from the region and helping out that way. All right, verse 9, "And with him, Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother." Notice how Paul talks about these people, right? Bear that in mind. You know, Paul was an important person in the God's plan, right? In the spread of the church. But Paul bends over backwards to highlight some people that may seem to be kind of insignificant to the story, right? And I don't believe there was any insignificant piece of the puzzle for the Apostle Paul. He speaks highly of there in verse 7, "This Tychicus was a beloved brother and faithful servant, fellow bondservant in the Lord." Then this Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother. Paul can find something good to say about most everybody. That's a good model, I believe. Yeah, yeah. There's going to be one in this list before we're done that Paul had some struggles with, a couple, in fact. So this our Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother, who is one of your number. So apparently this Onesimus was part of this church. They, Tychicus and Onesimus, will inform you about the whole situation here, Paul says. Remember, Paul's writing from prison. So it's likely, although it can't be probably proven definitively, but this is likely the same person as the slave whom Paul wrote to Philemon about. Philemon was a member of the church in Colossae, and it says here, this Onesimus is one of your number, so it would have to be a real stretch to probably think this is some other Onesimus, but it was a fairly common name in those days, so I never want to make a connection that can't be definitively proven, but I'm guessing that's the one spoken of here. This slave person, if you read the book of Philemon, you know that Onesimus was Philemon's slave who had left, ran away, and somehow encountered Paul, and Paul converted him to Christ. And then Paul writes a letter, and it's likely this private letter to Philemon was probably carried back by Tychicus at the same time as the corporate letter to the church. But Paul writes a letter to Philemon about this very Onesimus and says, you need to accept him back as a brother, and if he's wronged you in any way, I'll make it right. So Paul's trying to heal this wound. And again, imagine that if you can. You think about another minefield in the first century churches. You've got the Jew-Gentile problem that caused so much turmoil. Well, imagine, you know, the gospel was preached to all classes of people. Well, here you've got servant and master in the same church. Imagine working through some of those kinks in a fellowship. Paul is going to do that here. But he praises again this Philemon. Let me read from Philemon verses 10 through 14. Paul writes to that man in Colossae. He says, I appeal to you for my child Onesimus, whom I have begotten in my imprisonment. So again, the idea there likely is, you know, Paul, as he often did, he kept preaching even as a prisoner, and somehow he came across Onesimus and taught him the gospel. Verse 11, who was formerly useless to you, but is now both useful to you and me. So again, his change, his acceptance of the gospel has changed Onesimus into a different person. I have sent him back to you in person, that is, sending my very heart, whom I wish to keep with me, so that on your behalf he might minister to me in my imprisonment in the gospel. But without your consent, I did not want to do anything, so that your goodness would not be in effect by compulsion, but a free will. So Paul here is delicately handling this master-slave issue to everybody's benefit. That's likely what's going on here with Onesimus. I've done the same thing. It's you read it again and again and again, and some things don't click till later. So part of the...
Well, it's not definitive in the text.
Right.
Anyway.
Peter?
Well, if that's bad, what did Peter have to do when he converted a whole centurion?
Okay. And he had to go back to Jerusalem and report about it. Yeah. No doctrine being taught, but yeah. Yeah, this isn't just filler. You know, the Holy Spirit didn't have a contract with the publisher. You had to have so many words in each of these letters. You know, there's a reason. And again, part of it, I think, is just the everyday, you know, even with all we have in the New Testament about what was going on, they're just basic snapshots from here and there of a larger work that's been going on with all kinds of other people besides Paul and Peter and the ones that get most of the press. You've got Tychicus and Onesimus and the others that Paul mentioned there. And Lord willing, next week, picking up in verse 10, we'll talk about more of those. All right, thank you so much. Good discussion.